Next case is 06373, Vivian Miller versus First International Fidelity and Trust Building Limited. Mr. Roach.
Good morning. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Steve Roach. I represent appellant who owns the building. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please. Is a final appealable order turned into a non-appealable order by the discretionary filing of a motion for prejudgment interest? This case presents this court with an opportunity to decide this broader issue. The motion for prejudgment interest should be treated like the filing of a motion for relief from judgment pursuant to Civil Rule 60B of the Higher Rules of Civil Procedure, or a motion for reconsideration. Nothing in Appellate Rule 4 or other court rules or the prejudgment interest statute provides for delaying an appeal on the merits after the filing of a judgment entry on a jury verdict by the filing of a motion for prejudgment interest or for a 60B motion. Appellate Rule 4 does delay the beginning of the appeal time when certain motions are filed, such as a JNOV motion. In this case, when the judgment entry was filed on the verdict, the judgment entry was a final appealable order. An appellant could have filed its notice of appeal that day. The subsequent filing of a motion for prejudgment interest was discretionary. Civil Rule 54B of the Higher Rules of Civil Procedure allows piecemeal litigation and appeals pursuant to the sound discretion of the court, of the trial court. It's a bifurcation tool based on the sound discretion of the trial court.
If your first position is that the filing of a motion for prejudgment interest does not toll the time period for filing a notice of appeal to the Court of Appeals, then why does it make a difference that there's a 54B notification on the judgment entry?
There are courts that have interpreted the discretionary filing of a motion for prejudgment interest as transforming the judgment entry, as in this case, into a non-appealable or a piecemeal order, not a final appealable order, that requires discretionary finding by the trial court that an appeal on the merits shouldn't be delayed for a ruling that's still pending on the motion for prejudgment interest. And that's one of the reasons why we're asking this court to adopt appellant's position, is that discretion about whether or not to delay the appeal on the merits should be kept with the trial court. The trial court's in a position, and we believe did consider factors such as prejudice to the parties and judicial economy when it decided to include the 54B language. If the trial court did not think it was appropriate to delay, or if the trial court did think it was appropriate to delay an appeal on the merits, it wouldn't have included the language as it did in this case. Appellant also has argued that public policy and considerations of equity favor keeping the discretion with the trial court and allowing an appeal on the merits when the trial court finds no just reason for delay when a motion for prejudgment interest is pending.
But a trial court, you agree with the, we've got plenty of law that says the trial court just enunciating those 54B so-called magic words doesn't make it appealable.
Correct.
You'd agree. So we have to go behind, we have to look at the substance of actually what it was, that's being appealed, decide whether it's a final appealable order, don't we? Despite whatever the trial court says.
Yes, Your Honor. And
I didn't see the appellee cites us to State of Crow White versus Cuyahoga County Metro Housing Authority, which it's not right on point, but it's pretty close. I didn't see a response to you from you. What's your response to their cite to the White case?
I think two things, Your Honor. One is we would ask the court to treat a motion for prejudgment interest similar to a motion to assess costs, which the court in the White case notes is more of a ministerial type of motion and doesn't change a final appealable order into a non-appealable order.
Well, but costs are sort of ministerial, aren't they? I mean, there's a schedule. Every court has a schedule of costs for cases and various things that happen in a case. Prejudgment interest, that's a discretionary act of the court, is it not?
Well, it's part of agree damages. With what you're saying up to a point, Your Honor, but as you're familiar, there's disputes relative to costs, and there are plenty of appellate decisions from appeals relative to a decision about whether a particular cost that is sought to be assessed as part of court cost is or is not properly included. The other...
Isn't prejudgment interest more like damages than it is like cost?
I think that falls in a gray area, and it's a decision that the court will need to decide, which leads to the second point in response to your question, Your Honor. This court has decided that in criminal cases where court costs are assessed against the defendant, but aren't laid out or spelled out, that's another ministerial process that occurs after a judgment entry is entered. And even though, again, after the appeal is taken on that judgment entry, there may be some type of dispute in terms of what is or is not the proper cost to be assessed in a criminal case.
So, Counselor, are you saying that if a defendant fails to object to the cost assessed in their direct appeal, they have another shot at it?
No, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that, for example, like in this case, if after the judgment entry on the jury verdict is filed, a notice of appeal is then filed, at some point, a motion to assess cost is filed in the lower court. If the trial court doesn't stay deciding that motion, if there's some type of a dispute as to what is or isn't should be included, assess this cost, and does make a decision on the motion to assess cost, that decision could be subject to a subsequent appeal. In this particular case, after the judgment entry was filed on the jury verdict, a motion for prejudgment interest was filed, and discovery was issued seeking to look at the appellant's insurer's claim file. And the timing of that discovery is a bigger issue presented in this case, not whether or not the appellee is entitled to look at the claim file. A bigger issue is the timing of it, because if the appeal on the merits is delayed as appellee is seeking, and they're allowed to look at the insurance claim file and see privileged information that they weren't entitled to see before the first trial, if appellant is prevails on the merits and is given a retrial, the appellant is terribly prejudiced by the appellee now having the advantage of seeing the contents of the insurance claim file that may include some of the information discussed in the briefs. This type of prejudice is recognized and avoided by the trial courts in suits with bad faith claims through bifurcation. And my time is up, and I will sit down at this point. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Roach. Ms. Bacho.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Teresa Dewey Bacho, and I represent the appellee, Vivian Miller. I'd like to begin with a clarification of the underlying facts as it pertains to the judgments before this court and what I believe to be a mispresentation or assumption with regard to those judgments. The appellant addresses the underlying judgments as a single judgment. We do not have one single judgment in this case, which both determines liability and awards damages and contains the Civil Rule 54B language. We, of course, have two separate entries, as that is demonstrated in the record. The first is the entry on the jury verdict. That entry in and of itself, first of all, does not include the Civil Rule 54B language. But more importantly, that entry leaves itself open for a period of 30 days for the parties to submit their own JE, which we did, and that's discussed in the briefing. It also does not address the issue of cost. So on its face, that entry is not a final appealable order. The second entry, of course, is the entry addressing the very narrow issue of the appellant's post-trial motion for new trial or in the alternative judgment notwithstanding the verdict. If you read that entry, yes, it does contain the Civil Rule 54B language, but if you did not know this case, you would not even realize there was a pending motion for prejudgment interest. The trial court never mentions that in that motion.
Well, are you suggesting Judge Kerfus forgot about the...
No, of course not, Your Honor.
Seems the tough thing in this case, at least to me, is your argument that prejudgment interest is really another damage factor is pretty persuasive. But his argument that getting to see the claims file when there is a possibility of retrial is an unfair advantage to your client. And we could just explore the possibilities. An accident reconstruction expert hired who gives an unfavorable report, unfavorable to their case, and so they decide not to call him. They find another one, and that's who they use. You get into the file and you see that, and there's a retrial. You're certainly going to call somebody they hired and didn't call. That's a huge advantage, is it not?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe it's an advantage that we wouldn't have had already through discovery. Through pretrial discovery, we ask for experts whether or not they've been named or ultimately called. So, and through the Civil Rules 26, et cetera, that information should have already been disclosed. With addressing, following up in that question, and addressing the claims of injustice that appellant has set forth, I think those are very thin claims, and they're not supported by the record. The PACO decision, the Moskowitz decision of this court, obviously, we believe has already addressed those matters. Appellant claims...
So you don't think there's anything discoverable in their claims file that, in the prejudgment interest phase, that wouldn't have been discoverable... Anything that's useful. Obviously, how some executive at the insurance company evaluated the claim is not going to be something you could use in a second trial.
Certainly.
Anyway.
That's our position, Your Honor. There's nothing in that claims file that is going to ultimately be disclosed to me that is going to affect a retrial. The only thing he points to in their brief, the appellant points to in their brief, is theories of defense. Well, we know through the Moskowitz decision, anything they claim is privilege is going to come to the court for an in-camera review. The court's not going to just allow me to have open access to everything. If there is a legitimate theory of defense that comes under the attorney-client privilege, I'm not going to be permitted to have that. So that's the only thing they can present to this court they're fearful of, and the Moskowitz decision clearly takes care of that. I'm not going to get that. If you look at the two random cases that they cited as somehow misapplying Moskowitz and extending its application to allow a party to have access to documents that now are going to prejudice them on remand, I would submit if you look at those cases, that did not happen in those cases. The one case that was cited, the Wagner case, was quoted as having allowed thoughts and opinions of a consulting expert. Again, that's information that would have been disclosed appropriately through the pretrial discovery before the first trial. So that's nothing new. The other decision, the Radovanovich decision, in that case, the court specifically determined that the documents that were going to be allowed did not go directly to the defense. So the court applied correctly the Moskowitz analysis and prevented documents going to theories of defense from being disclosed. Those two cases do not support their position. But even assuming there's some random case out there that takes Moskowitz a step beyond what this court intended, this is not the avenue to correct that. The parties in that case certainly had recourse of appeal to resolve those issues.
Counsel, I unfortunately don't agree with you that there are information that you will discover that won't be helpful in a retrial. I think that is a very real danger and a very real possibility, having done a lot of this type of litigation myself. My concern, therefore, is very genuine that allowing prejudgment interest before you can appeal does really open a door that would have been sealed on retrial until that issue was resolved. Is it not fair to, and perhaps more economical, to say that prejudgment interest fits in the category of costs, as we have before, is an issue that does not have to be addressed until the appeal is resolved? Then if you lose the appeal and they win, you don't have to go through a hearing at all. If you win on the appeal, then you have your damages hearing, or most likely it will then be settled because there's nothing to be gained at that point. And so it seems to me that it makes it perhaps a clean line, instead of saying it's up to the discretion of a judge, a clean line that just says those issues simply don't delay an appeal and are post-appeal issues to be decided, or issues that are ministerial, even though they may have a hearing to determine the amount. It might be a clearer line to draw than even to leave it to discretion, is it not?
I would disagree respectfully, Your Honor. I think clearly the prejudgment interest is a much more involved analysis. It's more under the line of damages than cost. The State versus Cuyahoga decision that Justice Moyer mentioned earlier, the only exception would be if you're just a mere calculation, and that's not what's involved, as you know, under a prejudgment interest hearing. As far as the judicial economy issue, to suggest that this is going to preserve judicial economy or protect judicial economy is just, I think, wrong, and let me explain what I mean by that. As we know, the prejudgment interest statute was developed to promote judicial economy, of course, to encourage settlement and not waste the court's time. I think under appellant's proposition, to impose a delay in that hearing and an ultimate delay in the resolution of the entire claim is going to be very prejudicial and very time-consuming for all of the courts across the state. And I really think it's going to duplicate the appellate dockets of this state. Certainly it's going to save some time for the trial courts, and we're aware of the pressures on the trial court dockets. But if you follow the scenario of the appellant, the case is going to go to the Court of Appeals before the prejudgment motion hearing. If, of course, they get a remand, it's going to go back through trial, and who knows how many times it's going to be appealed on various issues. But let's say it goes to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals determines that the jury verdict was proper and affirms. That's not the end of the case. Now we got to go back to the trial court, start over with the discovery and the motion and the hearing, and whoever loses that is certainly going to appeal that decision. We're going to be back into the Court of Appeals. So at a minimum, this case and every case from here on will go to the Court of Appeals twice.
Do you believe that a trial judge should have discretion to say that there is information in this file that can prejudice you if the case is retried and refuse and allow it to be appealed before prejudgment interest hearing?
I would probably agree that that's the court's discretion, but that step was not taken in this case. Further on the judicial economy, if you follow what I believe this court has already set into motion and is established under the legislative sections that are in place, the whole case gets decided. Then we go up to the Court of Appeals. If the Court of Appeals affirms the underlying jury verdict, immediately can look at the prejudgment interest ruling and determine whether there is an abuse of discretion. Either way, if it determines no abuse of discretion, we're done. The case has gone up through the process just once. You have a final resolution, certainly much speedier, much more advantageous to all of the parties, but particularly a successful litigant, as we have here, Your Honor, who has a unanimous jury verdict in her favor. The trial court has already determined there's no right to a new trial, no JNOV that should be granted, and we're sitting and waiting for yet another appeal, where if this could get resolved, it's been 2.5 years, this matter probably could be done already. I don't think the judicial economy argument fits with this fact pattern at all.
Counsel, could you explain what the purpose of the 54B language then was in this case?
I don't know what the purpose of Judge Kerfess in putting that language in. We, as I believe Chief Justice Moyer indicated, we know there are decisions out there where trial courts include that language, and Court of Appeals and this court obviously determines that language has no meaning. Mm-hmm. Just simply putting that language in does not render a judgment final and appealable if it's not otherwise final. I can't read into why the judge put that in there. I would disagree with the amicus argument that the judge intentionally put the language in there to bifurcate, because I think if he had, I think that's reading too much into the decision. I think if he had, he would have mentioned that he was doing that. He would have mentioned the motion for prejudgment interest, but that was not done. So I think that's really giving too much reading to what the plain language of that decision
is. If there was a referral to the prejudgment interest motion, would you argue with the judge's ability to put the 54B language in? Allow it to be appealed?
I would, Your Honor. I would obviously not be able to argue that that was his intent, mm-hmm. but I would argue that that does not render that judgment final and appealable, because we have the underlying motion for prejudgment interest, which goes to damages, which is something that must be resolved in order to make the case final and appealable.
Isn't your argument also that under 54B that it refers to one claim for relief or multiple parties? We don't have multiple parties here.
Right, Your Honor.
And prejudgment interest, arguably, it's not a claim for relief.
Exactly, Your Honor. It's our position that the Civil Rule 54B language has absolutely no application to this case. The very heading of that civil rule indicates it's dealing with multiple parties and multiple claims, which, of course, there's no argument that we do not have that here. We would ask that the Sixth District's ruling be affirmed in its entirety. We believe the reasoning is appropriate. It's consistent with the prior decisions of this court, the Moskowitz, the White versus Cuyahoga decision, and that the matter be remanded with instructions from this court for the trial court to timely resolve the pending motion for prejudgment interest and related discovery issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dewey-Bacho. Mr. Roach, you've saved 4.5 minutes of your time.
Thank you. The only reason the trial court would have put the 54B language in is the motion for prejudgment interest was pending. There's no other reason for the court to have done that. And the trial court is in the best position to decide issues such as judicial economy, including the weighing or consideration of the chance of prevailing on the merits. The trial court has gone through the trial, has ruled on the post-judgment motion for a new trial and judgment notwithstanding the verdict. The trial court is in the best position to make a decision relative to delaying or not delaying an appeal on the merits. Just briefly,
so, counsel, would you say then you're not advocating for any particular hard and fast rule? It should be up to the trial judge on whether he or she is going to bifurcate the issues of if prejudgment interest is asked for?
Yes, Your Honor.
So it could differ from court to court? case to case.
Based on the sound discretion of the trial court, yes, Your Honor. Relative to the prejudice issue, there was some discussion about whether or not during the first trial and discovery, counsel would be entitled to get information about consulting experts as opposed to trial experts. And I think that's a distinction made in the case that counsel referenced. Normally, counsel wouldn't be able to get discovery relative to consulting experts except good cause is shown. That wasn't an issue in this case, but that's one of the possible prejudices that could happen if they're allowed to look at the insurance file on appeal before the merits are decided. An appeal goes forward on the merits and a possible retrial occurs.
Are you uncomfortable with having, with the process that Moskowitz, and I guess is common, somewhat common practice of having the trial judge make the decision in an in-camera proceeding of whether certain items in a file are going to be prejudicial if the other party sees them?
I'm sorry, your question.
Are you uncomfortable with that? I take it that you are uncomfortable with letting the trial judge determine whether material in an insurance company's file is going to be damages or prejudicial to the company in a second hearing if it's revealed to the plaintiff's counsel.
Only in the sense that Moskowitz talks about in a hearing or in discovery on a motion for prejudgment interest that there are privileges that aren't applicable under those circumstances that would have been applicable prior to the judgment being rendered by, or the verdict being rendered by the jury. And Ohio cases discussed in the briefing have allowed discovery of information that wouldn't have been allowed prior to the jury rendering its verdict. So there is information that if Appellee's position is adopted,
that would be grounds for an appeal, I assume. If you disagreed with what the trial judge's determination as to whether something's privileged or not, that's a grounds for an appeal, I would guess. And on the
well, but judgment. The cat's let out of the bag, Your Honor.
But if you lose in the second case, and you believe that the trial judge erred by permitting the plaintiff's counsel to see something or use information that it should not have used, then that's a grounds for an appeal, is it not, for a reversal?
Well, sure. Would it be? Is a grounds for appeal, maybe or maybe it won't be found to be prejudicial error or error at all. But from the litigant standpoint during a retrial, they still have the advantage of seeing information that they wouldn't have been able to see before the first trial. Unless the court has any other questions, I don't have any other points to make.
Thank you, Mr. Roach.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.